something, someone is mutilating animals around this planet. What are they? Who are they? In a moment, the crypto hunter, John Rhodes, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Oh, we've got a fascinating night for you tonight. John Rhodes, also known as the Crypto Hunter, is America's most outspoken, controversial UFO researcher. He is known around the world for his pioneering work researching reports of reptilian humanoid contacts and his out-of-the-box perspective regarding UFOs, alien encounters, the hollow earth, secret government technologies, and subsurface facilities. John has been a featured speaker at national and international UFO conferences, and his research discoveries have served as platforms for the beliefs of many other notable UFO conspiracy speakers and authors. He also acts as a professional consultant for literary and broadcast industry projects dealing with UFO-related subjects. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, welcome back. How are you?
Good evening, George. How are you?
Good. Always a pleasure to have you. Great subject matter tonight, especially on the heels of something that Linda Moulton Howe reported on us for us a week ago about animal mutilations. But let's talk with you a little bit, if we can, John, about just what you've been doing since you were last on with me.
Since I've been last on with you, I've been concentrating my investigative efforts up here in the western Montana area, as well as maintaining the point of contact for people across the world who claim to have had contacts or at least sightings of these half-human, half-reptilian beings that have been reported throughout the years. It's quite exciting. It seems to me that whatever's happening out there seems to be accelerating in pace as we start gathering closer and closer to more times ahead of us that probably have a lot of stress to do in our future, and a lot of testing for the courage of mankind, I should say.
You know, tonight we're going to talk about reptoids, and I'd like you to explain how you got involved in this kind of research.
Many years ago, I started hearing through the grapevine. I went to one or two of these local meetings where people were talking about aliens and such, and I thought it was a very entertaining thing to do, which it is, and it's very much a journey once you get into it. But when I first arrived, I started hearing one or two scattered reports that departed from the average description of what these alien beings look like. What I was hearing is that they are encountering beings who are very large in stature, 7 to 7.5 feet tall, sometimes much smaller, all the way down to 4 feet tall. And they are upright, humanoid-looking, although they've maintained certain parts of their outer characteristics that are very reptilian, such as scales or beaded skin, vertical slit pupils, lipless mouths, no ear canals, not a hair on the body, and a exterior that's much ranging in description from that of a linebacker weighing upwards of 350 pounds, more diminutive, wily-looking, sleek creatures or beings that kind of like mix in the physical descriptions. There seems to be so many variations upon the theme that it makes narrowing down what exactly is a reptoid or reptilian kind of difficult. It's kind of like looking at human beings. You have all these various forms of us, sizes, weights, skin colors, eye colors and such that you can't quite categorize it as one thing.
There was a report this week, John, that the humpback whale has a brain that almost echoes humans, which tells me that it must have or it has the capability of developing extreme intelligence. When you think of a reptoid, I think of a snake, I think of an alligator, a crocodile, you know, with their small little egg-shaped brains like a dinosaur almost. However, if they do exist on other planets and their brains are the size of human beings, then it's entirely possible that they have amassed superior intelligence, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, that's correct. But also we can't dismiss the fact that there were dinosaurs such as Troodon that Dr. Dale Russell had used as a model to define whether or not intelligence could be reached and what the advanced dinosaur form would look like if allowed to be developed. And under NASA contract, he actually came up with a model that was most frighteningly similar to what people have not only described in historical accounts, but also in today's current current trends of the UFO community and the reports that are coming in. So the idea of having an intelligent reptile on Earth is not so much a great departure as one would think. Truodon, Dr. Russell found out, it was actually headed in a convergent path with human upright position and larger brain mass. It had the largest brain mass out of all the dinosaurs. And this model has actually even been quoted in questions regarding extraterrestrial presence in our solar system, or in beyond our solar system, by the fellow colloquium in Los Alamos Laboratories, in which Frank Drake actually quoted some of Dale Russell's models. So this model is being used by the highest of science and government groups that are considering the question of whether or not there's evolved intelligent life forms living side by side with humans, or at least visiting them.
Explain to us what you believe the reptoids are.
I believe they are both byproducts of Earth's terrestrial evolution. Somewhere in the ancient past, a group of them may have been split away from the main populations on the surface. And when the catastrophic conditions of many millions of years ago occurred with the impact off of the Yucatan, a lot of those dinosaurs were pressed out of existence by various types of related disasters that were triggered by the initial impact. And the ones that scientists have said that were probably the last ones on Earth to live are the ones in Antarctica, because down there they had already been preconditioned for living in cold and freezing climates. And the dinosaurs that did down there actually developed, Tom Rich out of Australia, a paleontologist, discovered fossils in the cliffs along the southern coast of Australia, in which he said, look at the impressions of the back of the brain area here when you look in the inside of the skull. He said, these orbits are enlarged because this is the optical processing area of this dinosaur. In other words, the dinosaur could see in almost total darkness. So you're talking about a group of dinosaurs that may have actually been able to split off into the underworld, lived on microorganisms or funguses, adapted technologies or ways of surviving and developing genetically or evolutionarily just like human beings did. It wasn't, 200,000 years ago, look what we look like.
True. True. So you believe the reptoids are more earthbound than coming from some other planetary system?
I think by now they have probably left our planet system, have gone out to explore space, and rumor is that the ones who went off to explore space many thousands or how many, maybe a million years ago, who knows, are actually going to be coming back in 2012 is the point of return.
Now that could be a very fascinating moment.
We reached the galactic plane at that time, and along the galactic plane, scientists have discovered even a dark line in space in which they've seen the birth of stars. They have named this dark line that's directly in the center of the galaxy or the galactic plane the snake. So as we traverse the galactic plane, we're entering within the plane of that formation, and we also cross between the year of the dragon to the year of the serpent in Chinese mythology.
John, the very strange statues in Egypt that, you know, half bird, half man, half reptile, half man, might they be the reptoids too?
They very well could be. However, we have to remember that since the dawn of human evolution, the form of entertainment that people had back then was a matter of looking into their dreams, and they explored awakened dreams, the use of different types of hallucinogens. Repetitively throughout the world of the shaman and different cultural priesthoods, when substances like that are taken, there seems to be an abundance of images regarding reptiles come into their hallucinations or their visions. And the feelings they derive from these contacts, and I say contacts because even the late he skips my mind. He was talking about drug use, and he died in Hawaii.
Thomas McKenna?
Help me out here. Somebody in the audience. Yes. Terrence McKenna. Right, communicated with me at one time, and he said that the most highly impacting vision he ever had was something that was half man and half snake. And he said he didn't know where it came from. He thought and considered my postulations, but really couldn't say anything for himself other than it was life-changing for him.
Some of these theories, though, John, echo David Icke's with regards to reptilians, don't they?
Well, you have to wonder where David Icke got them. A lot of this discussion was on the scene before David Icke decided to start producing here in the United States and coming over from England with his ideas of conspiracies. And so this is during a period in which I dropped out of the UFO scene because, you know, you get to a point of saturation where you think nobody wants to know. I was coming along saying, look, there's something different coming on the scene here, and it's Earth-derived instead of space-derived. Maybe we're looking in the wrong direction. And even as open-minded as we are in the UFO community, we still fall within the parameters of our scope of vision, and that just wasn't there at the time. And I backed off, and the information started to blossom and grow. It turned into a very negative thing, although I feel that there's negative and positive everything. And if you want to talk about reptoids, we could talk about really, really, really evil ones. Can you imagine a military reptoid being able to run 48 miles an hour? That was clocked speed. No, 38 miles an hour was clocked speed by a gentleman back in Bishopville, South Carolina in 1988 when he was a full bird colonel about to be promoted to full general in the Army. And he had reported to the sheriff Terliston Truesdale down there, that driving along that swamp with his wife beside him coming back from a wedding rehearsal, and Baptists don't drink, so he wasn't drinking, he clocked a half-man, half-dinosaur guy running alongside his car at 38 miles an hour. Now, can you imagine our troops facing something like that on the battlefield? So, in other words, we're talking about something that could be very, very frightening to have to deal with, but at the same time, we haven't met their women. We haven't met the females. I mean, we haven't met their children. There must be artists. There must be a whole culture behind them. We can't judge the actions by the ones who are interacting with us right now on their whole and project that on their whole culture.
Whereabouts within the planet are they? Deep below?
They're in various places all across the planet, mostly in geologically remote areas that are beyond our scope of exploration. There are large cavern and tunnel systems that are throughout the whole world. The jewels of the planet, the jewels of all the historical things we're looking for and all the answers to aliens, if we just turn the UFO thing upside down on its back and look at it from a different perspective, in other words, focus on where their visitor bases are here, where their ports of entry are, what kind of policing they have to make sure that no rogue groups come down and interact with us when they're not supposed to. Who are the mercenaries coming to our planet trying to steal our technologies or other beings' technologies? These are they're all over the place in deep cavern systems that some of them are linked to sensitive laboratories that I believe that our government is operating. And at the same time, they may be just living in pocket cultures deep underground. Their civilization may have been told that there's a vacuum to space. Don't go up there, and if you do, there's monsters there that will kill you. And they're mammal monsters that kind of look like us, but they will kill you before they will talk to you.
Wow,
you know, so we must think, yeah, the whole thing must be upside down, perhaps. And if we can direct our attention to where it's more, we can see in our backyard, we have to depend on these scientists to tell us what they find out in space. But every single person out there listening to me right now can actually do something by reading in the armchair your research and then getting out and going out and doing it. Because once you start looking into the phenomenon is very John Keelish, it will look back at you.
Since you brought up the military, did the United States order the Navy, especially all ships, September 11, 2002, to do something? What happened?
In honor of the dead of September 11, 2001, the United States military, the United States Navy, was ordered to start raising the first Navy Jack. The first Navy Jack is the very famous flag in which you see 13 red and white horizontal stripes, and across it you'll see a picture of a rattlesnake and the words, "Don't tread on me." This is very much a part of American history. The first, the Commodore Esop Hawkins, who was the commodore of the first American Navy, actually readied his fleet in the Potomac and used the flag as a signal to the whole fleet to engage the enemy. This is what our government has decided to use as its traditional standard in the war against terrorism. And in today's times, when everybody starts talking about they believe in Armageddon, such as the leader of different various Middle East states who believe that in their heart, when you have the President of the United States who himself must feel something towards Armageddon because he declares himself to be such a great Christian in these days, when you have these people who think that we are in those times and these signs start coming up, you wonder, are they trying to force prophecy? Because really we're looking at, when the snake is on a flag on U.S. naval ships, we're thinking about the Leviathan, as it is in the traditional text of the Bible. Because if you read those texts, and I haven't got the points right now, but everybody out there, they'll find them. When it talks about the Leviathan, it talks about something that sounds more metallic and more like a machine than it does a biological animal. So are we really living in some sort of convergence of this kind of like subconscious matrix of all life on Earth? And all these symbols that we've predicted to come true, we're actually pulling them together, because the only way for a good world tomorrow is to have the end of this world today.
These reptoids, what do they eat?
Difficult to say.
Don't tell me us.
Well, it was once, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but it was once written on a billboard out in Los Angeles for weight loss and going to the gym, that it said, and there was so much of a public demand and outrage, they took the signs down, but it had a sign up and it says, when aliens arrive, they'll eat the fat ones first. So, you know, we don't want to think that they have a choice for us, you know, how big we are or anything, but I think we're dealing with animals or beings that are both carnivorous and herbivores, probably just like ourselves. There may be different types of proteins and different types of things that their systems require that we've more or less adapted to on the surface. And there may be delicacies that they enjoy that we would not otherwise find appetizing, just as we would in different parts of the world where they eat all kinds of things, that at least anything that has a heartbeat sometimes. So we haven't had any reports of anybody being bitten by a reptoid. We have never had a report of anybody being half-eaten by a reptoid, so I don't think we have to worry too much about that, although you will hear in some of the conspiracy rings that, oh, so many children in a year die and this, that, and the other. We can't blame it just on the reptoids. So I don't know. The diet is yet to be determined, but you're right. I hope that to serve humanity isn't the cookbook.
What about mutilating animals, John?
Mutilating animals, I think, is a fascinating subject. I'm not so much in the hows it's being done, although that's very fascinating, and I want to get to the bottom of it. But really, my search in the subject matter of the mutilations is, what are the messages they're trying to tell us? It may not be as black and white as trying to figure it out. It's like you have 10 people standing around a stone that weighs 50 tons and it's so many feet high and so many feet wide, and they're going, look how the rock was cut. Isn't it beautiful? I wonder who did this and this, that, and the other one. If you step far enough back, you'll see it's only one stone of many that make up a design or a word. You can't see it until you step back from it. And I think that there's more of an underlying message in the way they're putting the bodies and the way they want them to be seen. Some of the scenes have been staged. So really, what is the psychological aim of what's being done? The medical is beyond my reach as a person, many people out there. However, the psychological, we've all dealt with game players. Maybe we can just figure these out too.
Hey, John, we are going to bring in Sheriff Tom Kuka in just a moment. He is a sheriff in Montana, and he's got an incredible story to tell. And welcome back. We're with John Rhodes. John, tell us a little bit about Sheriff Tom Kuka, if you would.
Sheriff Tom Kuka is a very rare breed of man. He's a sheriff up in Pend'Oreille County, Montana. Pend'Oreille County covers about 33,300 square miles. It's known as the Golden Triangle area because there's a whole bunch of wheat, barleys, and grasses there that give us this beautiful golden hue. You've got the Rocky Mountain Western Front around the edge of it, and it's just some of the most scenic, beautiful country in America. In that area, he got a call from a childhood friend of his that had informed him that there was a cattle mutilation on his ranch. And he responded to the scene, and I'm going to let him pick up that story. But the thing here is that we went there together. We looked at the evidence, obtained samples and stuff. The entire mutilation case is being documented for a DVD. And Sheriff Kuka is really reaching out to the public at this time and, you know, trying to let you know that there is a sense of concern amongst the law enforcement officials that we finally get to the bottom of this. He represents many law enforcement officials that wouldn't have the courage to come out to the public and actually start letting them know right from the front lines exactly what's going on.
Very good. Sheriff, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you very much.
Good. Are you the same sheriff that brought in Linda Moulton Howe for help in an investigation? Because she was just talking about a case up in your neck of the woods.
Yes, we did. What happened, we called her for some information, and it just kind of progressed into the fact that she came here.
Well, she is. She's the best, so I'm glad you had her out there as well, and I'm glad, John, that you've brought the sheriff with us. Sheriff, tell us a little bit about this episode here that that occurred in your county.
Okay, well, as we can tell, this is about the 21st one, say, in the last six, 7 years, somewhere in there. They're all so relatively close to the same thing. There always seems to be part of the face, one side or the other, usually the left side that's cut off, and I mean with exact precision. There isn't any muscle or meat left on that bone. That jawbone is clean right down to the bone. There's usually no udder left that has been cut out without damaging any tissues underneath it. And the rectal area, of course, is cored out also.
And that you have seen no evidence of footprints or some means or way that somebody or somebody's got into this pasture and area to take these animals?
No, we have not. And that's the part that I guess frustrating to us is we would like to have some kind of evidence and some place to go to, but we just keep coming up against the same thing.
You've seen a lot of crime scenes before.
Oh,
you're able to pinpoint much information about various crimes. In this particular case, are you baffled?
To a certain extent, yes. I would, you know, getting to talk to people like John sure helps out, makes us realize, you know, we're not alone in this situation. There's a lot of other people out there that are going through the same thing. And hopefully, with the public getting involved with it, maybe we can get some more information out there, somebody that actually sees something or knows what's going on and
get,
find something positive out.
This was the case, Sheriff, where the animal was dropped and left an indentation in the ground, if memory serves me?
Yes. I guess, there was some indents in the ground there. We had two different spots where there was indentations in the ground, but they weren't like anything, footprints or anything.
No.
They were very symmetrical marks. And there's also a impression mark in the stubble where you could see what appeared to be that cow that hit and then came to rest about 7 feet north of that impression mark.
Any idea how high up a cow would have to be to make that kind of an impression if it were dropped?
No, I don't have a clue. And I'm not sure what force it would take to lift that. This is probably, you know, a 1,200, 1,300-pound animal. I know it's going to take some force to get it up in the air, but once it comes down, it's going to be moving right along, that's for sure.
Sheriff Kuka, were there any eyewitnesses to this? Did anyone see strange lights, a craft in the air, anything like that, or some predator running from the scene?
No, there wasn't anything quite like that. First of all, this one was a little bit different than some of the other cases we worked or similar cases to this, in the fact that these cattle were moved in there one afternoon, and the next morning, the neighbor saw this cow laying there dead. However, they didn't notify the Petersons that this animal was dead. So it took another day and a half before they located it, which was somewhat unfortunate. It would have been nice for us to get there right away. But there just wasn't time for anything such as predators, or at least the small predators it would have taken, you know, to do the damage to this cow. As you might know, with us bringing forward all this information, we've gotten a lot of calls. And there's a lot of people that want to offer different opinions as to what happened. But I just don't believe there was small rodents that were eating these or making these incisions in this animal. I just can't believe that they didn't have time to get it done.
A lot of my friends. Go ahead, Sean.
If I may interject here, I spoke this evening with Bob Hames, who is a former city councilman in the area. Bob was the gentleman, the rancher neighbor of the Petersons, that actually helped me sever the head off and contain it for examination and ice, and get it frozen as soon as possible. He told me this evening that even after the head was excised and that bare meat was laid fresh open for anybody or anything to see, 3 days later he went back to the scene, and even though there's a free steak sitting there, bloody red almost, not one predator bit into it at all.
That's correct.
If you can imagine that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a free meal sitting there, just juicy, waiting to be bitten into, and they say no.
They didn't want any part of it, did they?
No part of it.
Now, the night that we did respond to this, there was a coyote within a quarter of a mile of this carcass, and he didn't come into it either. And he was seen there the next day within a quarter of a mile and still wouldn't go over to it.
He probably said, Sheriff, I'm as close as I'm going to get. I've got a lot of friends in law enforcement in St. Louis and in Los Angeles. A lot of the times they will tell me that they work on gut instinct on certain cases. What does your gut, Sheriff, tell you about this thing?
You know, we're working with some kind of technology here that nobody else has seen around this area, probably maybe nowhere. To be able to go in there, remove this one animal, and it has to be taken someplace and processed, the work that was being done to it, and then brought back and not being detected. It tells me that we're talking to somebody that, you know, not your average Joe Blow criminal. This individual definitely has this planned. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he has some fantastic equipment to get it done.
Sean Rhodes, to bring an animal back after doing what's being done, to me, illustrates that they want us to see it, and they're basically trying to send us a message. What's your take?
Right. I mean, that seems to me to be the case. You know, I didn't bring it to Tom. I didn't bring this to your attention, but I was recognizing today that, in fact, there's been October 9th of 1975 in Judith Basin County, Utica, there was a undersheriff by the name of Jerry Skelton. He had a bull calf that was found dead, and its testicles and cords removed. Only around the carcass, there was a pile of stones, and somebody had taken the stones and placed them around as if they were putting something on display. The next morning, the cow was discovered after some rain and dew had hit it and some light snow, and it had a petroleum distillate cobweb that had formed over the animal. Now, the thing that's important there is the date, October 9th, 1975, and then you have the stones piled up, meaning they were trying to send a message. It's not a matter of, you know, how the stones were put there. It's a matter of what are they trying to say with them. Now, this mutilation also occurred October 9th, 2006. That's exactly 31 years later to the day. Now, in this case, the cow was deposited in an area that was 500-plus acres in which it could have been deposited, like out in the coulee where nobody would see it for a few days. But instead, it's deposited only 18 feet from a fence, which is 36 feet from a road, which is only less than a mile from a government NORAD nuclear missile silo. So there's a thing here where they're trying to put something on display, and I think there's an underlying message here that we should be focusing on. It's trying to do the psychological profile of a killer, right, Sheriff?
Exactly.
Right.
And this isn't the first one that we've had that's like that also. They're not hard to get to. They're not hard to see once, you know, people get there to look. It's just we have so much ground out here to try and cover. Sometimes it takes several days before you'll find it.
Sheriff, what is some of you? I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
I was going to say, in addition to that, The thing that makes it difficult is the square miles having to be covered over such a large area with such a light population. But also, when evidence does come to hand, the sheriff's departments are really not prepared economically to start paying for a lot of scientific testing. So there is evidence at hand, even that I have, where if there was money coming in from somewhere that could pay for the testing, that would be greatly appreciated. That's one of the reasons I'm putting the DVD together, and 20% of the net proceeds from the DVD called Whatever Happened to Cow Number 62, because this was cow number 62 of 200. That money will go towards the Pend'Oreille County Sheriff's Department for buying equipment such as forensic lab testing stuff, anything that could help in their field testing, cameras, anything that they might need to do the job. And I think we as the public, when you have a person such as Tom Kuka here coming out to address this and give it such high profile and support from authorities, that we really need to send something back in his direction. Because if he can't get help, maybe we can do it. Maybe we can give him the help that he needs and that county.
Sheriff, what are your constituents out there saying about all this?
Well, they're probably the same thing, frustrated like me. They want to be able to help the people that they work for, want to be able to tell them, hey, we're going to do our best to get to the bottom of this and stop it. This whole economy around here is based on agriculture, and cattle is a large portion of that. And that's for, a young couple that's out there working, one of these producing cows is a big loss to them.
Are they scared? Are people scared out there?
I don't think I've really caught it that. Oh, a couple people have mentioned, that that just makes them feel odd, which when you go to this scene and you know that something or somebody had been there and done this to this animal, it's a, strange feeling. It's like, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but because I guess we don't know, we're working with the unknown so much here that we can't explain it, and that's maybe the part that's so hard to accept.
Do you agree with that, Sean?
I very much do, and it takes a lot of man hours to try and even think this thing together and try and put together the clues. And law enforcement stretched thin as it is anyway because of budgets in certain areas and such, and I think that what we have here is an elusive prey, one that is not impossible to catch. Because you put somebody like Tom Kuka or the support that he's got behind him, or Razzle Rathbone together with like Sherlock Holmes, eventually somebody's going to slip up. And I have a feeling it's going to be soon, because Sheriff Tom Kuka is hot on their trails. And now, if I can, Sheriff Kuka, there's been a misunderstanding of some sort of miscommunication in regards to my severing the cow's head and taking it for examination. Has it been said that I took it without permission? Can you clear this up? Because you were standing there when everybody
is that talking. Is that an issue? Okay.
Yeah, it is an issue because it's been said about what I've done.
Yes. We were there with John at the site, both myself and the rancher, and we got done with our interview and discussing the case, and he asked if he could have samples of this cow, and we said absolutely, and we're all done. We've taken our samples. In fact, that's part of the problem with part of the tissue samples that we took. We had no place to go with them, so we said, I got nothing to do with them, so absolutely take what you need. And then when we came back, the head was gone, and we said, holy cow, the head's gone. it wasn't an issue, and it actually it was quite interesting for a couple of different reasons. It was good that they did take it off. So, yes, it was simply a misunderstanding. And there was never, ever any problems with John removing that head. And
okay, well, I appreciate that, Tom, because it's important to be able to get out to that field and feel free that you leave room for other people, but at the same time you preserve the evidence for the case.
I'm not trying to, like I said, I've had just so many people that have called and talked about this, and I try to take time to listen to all of them. Anything that anybody can tell me, especially like you, when you get the forensic work done on this head, maybe, we'll learn something from it that'll help us go and channel all our efforts into one area or,
Right. Right, and it does take a team effort, and law enforcement shouldn't be by themselves anymore. That's why we, the people who really find this entertaining and fascinating, we're learning so much about our environment and what's going on, we really need to support the people that are on the front lines, and I really do appreciate you being able to come out, Tom, and talk about it. It takes courage, and I know that you're hot on the trail.
Well, we're going to do the best we can here, but you know, a community like ours, it takes a lot of community policing to get all this work done. If we don't get calls from the public, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to happen we will not get to. We have to respond to a lot of stuff. And this is going to be no exception to that. We just need help with the public. Anything that they see or hear, which has always been lacking in all of this, we've had a couple of these in the past. I just found out about one the other day from 2001, where after we had done the investigation, we had a lady that had been driving by there and said she saw some lights out in the field at the time that we thought that a mutilation had occurred. But other than that, nobody's seen anything or heard anything during these. And, of course, that's part of the problem with being in a sparsely populated area. There's just not enough people to cover all the ground.
Can you rule out, Sheriff, a cult or poachers?
Yes. Poachers, for instance, would be, if they were doing it, I think they would be doing it for a reason, such as...
And they'd take the whole animal.
Taking the meat for something to eat or to
yes.
sell for profit. We don't have a problem with cults here. I don't think we ever have. However, I've heard of them and the things that they do. We would be having other issues with those people other than just, you know, mutilating animals. And the way that they go about their mutilation. I talked to a gentleman about this once, and he won't even call these mutilations. He says, whoever's doing this knows exactly what they're doing, and it's very precise. He says, mutilation does not represent what is happening to these animals.
Well, I got to tell you, Sheriff, this is as bizarre as it comes, isn't it?
It is for me. I just haven't seen anything like this before. And that's one of the other things that I wanted to mention. John is probably the first one to tell you he's not surgically inclined, and they had just a little bit of trouble removing that head. If you could see damage they did to the tissue underneath that skin compared to the cuts that were done to that animal prior to that from this mutilation, then there would be no doubt in anybody's mind, you know. That...
And Bob Hames, who helped me, he's a skilled dresser. He's dressed field game many years in his life, a real hunter. So, he knew exactly what he was doing with that knife.
Exactly, yeah. And he still, there was a lot of damage to that tissue underneath. And had you not done that, you know, that would have been never seen for comparison. So that was, you know, something very, I guess, worthwhile about removing that head that came out of it.
Sheriff, thank you.
Experience.
I appreciate you, Sheriff, being on the program. John, you stay with us for the rest of the 2 hours.
Okay, very good.
And I'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. More to talk about now, these reptoids. Are they mutilating these animals? John, reptoids, do you think that they might be responsible for mutilating these animals?
Well, if they are the dominant life form on Earth or in Earth or governing our terrestrial atmosphere, I would have to say that they are in some way either involved or definitely allowing it. When we talk about things like mutilations and such like that, you have to think of the different avenues we've considered. People have thought about government operations, corporations, or some highly advanced and very wealthy pharmaceutical group that's doing it and doing something to the cows. We've also got to talk about different things, even as far as interterrestrials or other civilizations that might be needing things that from the tissues or from the blood of these animals. And that includes the reptoids. And then finally, on top of that whole thing, you have to think about whether or not there's an interdimensionality to this. Are these beings coming from another dimension, and possibly when they densify too long here, they start requiring nutrients that are absorbed through skin or something like that because they can't get what they're normally getting. It doesn't seem that it's something that's actually supporting a population of a very large group, considering how much tissue is taken. So Are the reptoids involved? There has been a case in which a mutilation took place in which there was a three-toed contact. After getting involved in the case, I have colleagues who have been working in UFO research since the 1950s and before the 60s, and they said just to be aware that there's probably going to be a three-toed footprint around my residence. And just yesterday I found one, but I think it was a moose. So because I live out in the country,
sure.
The country of Montana, where you have moose walking around in your backyard sometimes. But yes, I would have to say that it's probably all of those things. There's probably, it's just like the crop circles. You have the legitimate one happen. Then you have a couple guys coming out saying, oh, yeah, we did them all, although we don't have the complex geometry education that needs to do them. And then you've got perhaps art groups who are trying to do them then. And you've got government groups that are trying to do it to distract you from looking at the real ones. So enough of these reports come in where they're obviously fake, that somebody walks away from listening to the phenomenon as something that it all must be fake. We're talking really about crypto communications, because the aliens or the beings that are interacting with us now do not want to spell things out in the sand. They're not going to write it down in English. And they very well could. If they're that intelligent, they must know the ABCs. They must know the English language.
Sure.
Why don't they start doing something in an English language that is made with a overlacing crop circle, genetically changed plant structures, and all the classical signs of it? The mutilations are very much the same thing. The Mexico City, why do they allow themselves to be seen in mass in Mexico City but nowhere else? What is the message behind even that? So we have to stand back from this a little bit, not get so caught up in looking through such narrow focal point that we miss the big message. And I think that really there's a big message out there that's one of spiritual transformation and transformation of one's own psychology and spirituality, because that's what it really comes down to the end, is how are you handling it, and how is what you're learning transforming you inside, you, the listener, you, the participant in the phenomenon. When you start injecting yourself into it, like I said, it will find you. How do you react to it when you make contact with it? And maybe this is the whole veil thing, where the veil's thinning. There seems to be a thinning of frequencies, and we're having interactions now more because we're a little more desensitized to things and maybe not living so much out of fear. Not that fear's wrong, because to tell you the truth, I don't know if I mean, it takes a certain constitution to sit up and face something like a 7.5-foot-tall guy with long, razor-sharp claws that just with a flick of his finger could cut you up and down your chest and have your heart drop out.
Do you believe in some of these theories, John, that people think that these reptoids are among us now, but they kind of shape-shift? They've gotten involved in politics and science and media. And they're all over the place?
Let's take this on two levels, and yes. First thing is that we're talking about people, individuals, who I've had contact with throughout the years, who feel a certain draw towards the information regarding reptoids, and these people, when they allow themselves psychological or emotional vulnerability, find themselves in a position of feeling their muscles change and they're changing and they feel like they're shape-shifting. Now, in all essence, are they going to shape-shift into another animal completely? We don't know. But what we do know is that there's some sort of involuntary action happening with those individuals when they're not even aware they're doing it. And I've heard this on more than one occasion, and from some very credible people, that like wives who say, I love my husband and everything, but there are occasions when he's walking around the house and I'm looking at him where he's focused in something else, but his face looks like it's moving and changing into something or someone else, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And this is a very unsettling thing to say. So are we talking about hybrids? Are we talking about Rh-negative hybrids that have had contact and somehow through their genetic lineage they have had certain information encoded within their genes from maybe several generations back that they're tapping into with their subconscious, and this is what is happening to them? They're feeling an entropy or a collapsing of consciousness at that time to where they're getting in connection with their DNA information and it's affecting the cells of their body. That could be. And we're also talking about, could other people in figures of power also be reptilian humanoid? And I cannot say no, but I've always said it's too easy to start a witch hunt and just blaming everybody for the ills of mankind. So I think that we've gone there, been there, done that. Everybody's heard that. Everybody's getting tired of it because it was that so much that way. And everybody's tired of the hatred because, you know what, if we're going to get along with these guys, then we're going to have to get past this angst, and we're going to have to know that there's a certain amount of respect due. There is a certain amount of fear of even your neighbor, because otherwise you're going to go do things on his lawn or harass him or something like that. So you do have a certain respectful fear of each other. But at the same time, there's a huge amount of industry that is on the precipice of change here. We are about to maybe encounter something else in which you got huge industries being formed. You've got anti-gravity magnetic or anti-magnetic gravity devices or vehicles being made. You've got an industry of cultural exchange that could actually really make humanity blossom if we give it a chance. I would hate to think we get in touch with something and we get falsely led down into a Pearl Harbor just because we've been led to believe that something's coming here to harm us when we really don't know that. But history has taught us, I think, by now, for us to look for the fruits of their actions rather than by what we're being told, because we've been misled before. And it doesn't mean we can't entirely trust our government or what people are saying, but I think that there's going to have to be something happening at a level in which really those command structures are taken out of the equation. And I don't mean militarily, but I mean just by some sort of a contact happening between an average Joe Blow and a culture. Maybe that's the only way it can happen, to guarantee we don't get all these other games being played on us.
You know, the reptoid theory, if it's accurate, tells you that we are either very naive as a society or we don't have any control over this. Is it possible governments are working in tandem with them?
I believe that the United States government is, probably the UK-USA group, which includes Australia and also Canada, part of the Commonwealth, because they control echelons, so they get to listen into everybody's phone calls. So if there's something going on, they probably know what it is. Are they working side by side? It appears to be so. It appears that some of these inner Earth beings may actually be working side by side with the highest levels of our government black elite, and what I mean by black operations, elite groups, and leaderships. How far have they infiltrated into our society is unknown because, you know, look at the works that Jacques Vallée has done. Look at the works that Tom Adams has done and all the great people like John Keel. There's obviously something going on here where we have no control over it. But if when you're a government, how can you say to your people, we have no control over it? And by the way, the invasion will never come because it happened many years ago, or else they're living underneath our feet, and they're older than mankind. So that's a very challenging thing for people to suddenly be confronted with.
What do you think?
It's not a matter of hiding. It's a matter of being sandwiched from above and below.
What do you think they think of us?
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
All these things happening on the surface, they're probably saying, we don't want to come out.
Yeah. Well, they're probably saying, let them kill themselves off. Why don't, you know, let them get to the point of being masters of their own devastation and thin out the herd a little bit. So when there is contact, maybe it's going to be after a period of natural cyclical devastations on the surface of the Earth. Because you know what? If I were an alien being and I was in charge of a group and I said, you know what, when's a good time to go down there? I'd probably say, you know, I see down the pike here, our scientists are saying that there's going to be massive earthquakes around here. The whole industries are going to be shaken up. People are going to become nomadic, and there's going to be refugee problems, and the whole industry is going to fall apart. So in other words, it's kind of like the collapse of their civilization. Why don't we show up at that time? Because they're already in the state of psychological damage. They're already psychologically damaged. Why postpone it? So when a whole world society builds itself up again, you have to risk tearing it all down by your presence, because we've proven that through anthropology. In all these ancient cultures we came into, we devastated them. And that's exactly what Arthur C. Clarke said in his 1953 book, Childhood's End, in which he says that there's an advanced race of reptilian humanoid beings that are coming back to Earth, claiming this is their original home planet, and he wrote in the foreword of his book that the opinions offered in this book are not those of the author. So, Mr. Clark, whose opinions were they?
That's a good point. Do they, but, you know, they're earthbound, they could be extraterrestrial. We really don't know for sure, do we?
Both. I think they're both. And if they were here, if they are that advanced more than we, then they are obviously beyond the parameters of our scope of vision when it comes to what kind of science they've developed. So they're probably on other planets in contact with maybe even other dimensions as we speak. Remember, we're just a babe in the woods.
That's true. Well, what exactly, how do they look? Describe them to me.
There's various forms. There seems to be a command structure going on. The grays that arrived on the scene after the Space Brother things of the 1950s and 60s, these were diminutive small beings that looked like we could overpower them physically even, but we just couldn't manage to because we have weak minds and they have ray guns and stuff. Then, gradually, we started hearing these reports of where people are saying, a woman would wake up, she's saying, I had an experience last night and I'm not sure how to describe it. I'd say, well, what happened? There was a being in my room. He was very overpowering and large. He was half human, half reptile, and his skin would glisten, and he would have a sheen to him, and it was brownish green. And I was overpowered psychologically through the shock, but he also had whatever happened during the encounter got into her chakra levels and gave her an experience in her chakras and in her energy akin to something of a sexual orgasm, and because it's connected with the spine and the kundalini wrapping up mm-hmm. the spine. And when you have another energy that's of a higher vibration and you bring it into your field, you rise up. That's why people, after a contact, all of a sudden they'll have a raised abilities of psychic abilities, and then after a while it winds down. It's because we're slowing down our vibration after the event. But these guys are large. They've got very broad shoulders, some of them. They almost look like a gladiator, a typical gladiator. Their scales on their hands and the flexible parts of the arms are all small, and the face is small. The scales are in more flexible areas like the neck, but when it gets down towards the chest and other areas, the chest has larger scales, not huge plates like a cockroach, but like large scales or scutes, and they've got three fingers with an opposable thumb, large eyes that tend to wrap around the sides of their heads. I have a report from a very good, credible witness that I've confirmed other elements of stories of his that have checked out. This man tells me, and his wife was sitting right there, and it's a big joke to them, that they had an encounter with something like a MIB after sending sent a letter to the government saying, I know there's an underground base here and I want a job. And the next thing you know, he sent it to Washington. The next thing you know, their truck would not start, and they had to go to the post office. And they said, okay, we'll walk. And they started walking. Here comes the black car. The door pops open. They look inside. She looks inside. She backs up. She gets behind him and pushes him through the door. And when she's telling me the story, she says, I didn't send the letter. I'm not sitting next to that man in black in the back seat. So you get this real honest type of approach to the story. And when he was in the back seat, he said he looked at this guy, and the glasses wrapped a little bit around the sides of his head, but he could actually see that so did his eye socket.
Gee.
And these guys in the 1970s were using cell phones in a car. And they knew exactly where he was going, and they dropped him off at the post office, and they said, we will be back to pick you up and give you a ride home. And so when they left the post office, they ran out the other way and hid behind a tree and were scared to death that these guys were really going to offer them a ride home, and they didn't want it.
Well, these reptilians, do they also have tails?
Yeah, some of them have tails. Some of them don't. The ones that seem to be in command are what they call the Draco, and this is like a classical Satan-looking like image that has been passed down through the ages. Very large, a reptoid with horns that stand about 3 to 4 inches off the head, that are conical in shape, a back-sloping head. They have wings that look like they could lift them up and fly, that are made of like a leathery material. And this gets into the whole Mothman things and identifications of flying
good point.
Humans. You have to wonder if there's some of these guys floating around.
Good point. Do their faces look somewhat human, or do they look more crocodile-like?
No, they look more human than anything. One was reported to almost look like beaded skin of a lizard. So horny protuberances out of their head or their eyebrow areas is not very common. There have been some that have thought to have been seen with a beard, but they're not sure if this is a quills. You know, some lizards have quills that hang down underneath their chins.
Mm-hmm.
And these might be perceived of as fine hairs. In Bishopville, South Carolina, where this colonel had seen one and reported it to Sheriff List of Truesdale out there, he said that he saw a man, was half man, half dinosaur, but local residents often say that these things look like Bigfoot. There's a confusion there. I've spoken to one individual that said, well, it was an old guy. He lived alongside a small road. He said he saw this thing run across his road. It was kind of small and thin-looking. It looked like it was hairy, but at the same time, he looked down, and he could see all of a sudden the hair terminate, and there were these snake-like legs, like a lizard, and he actually left three-toed prints behind after he scampered off. Well, I think that we're actually hearing about reports of these beings living in swamp areas in the wilderness who actually themselves might be kind of like we think of something like the Ozarks way out in the woods or something where maybe people dress down, you know. Maybe these guys are wearing furs. And ladies, if you're out there and you're thinking of this, I mean, what lady doesn't want, you know, to get a nice fur once in a while?
Well, some of them aren't into that anymore. Things have changed, John.
Well, yeah, with us. Hopefully, you know, with them they're not wearing human skin, but it doesn't seem like that. But what I'm saying here is that they might be wearing these things for warmth because they're naturally their body temperatures are regulated by their surroundings, so they need to wrap up warmer. And also maybe to be, if in case they are worried about being hunted, to be misidentified as a bear or something. So that's why you get these reports that some people say, you know, like, oh, it looked like a Bigfoot, but it had scales or it's leaving three-toed prints. I think this is where what we're really looking at in this phenomenon.
Hey, John, some people have said that these reptoids are part of alien abductions. Let's talk about that when we come back. And also, the National Geographic has just done a show on chupacabras. I want to get your reaction to that as well. John, before I ask you about some chupacabra information, because you are the crypto hunter, let's talk a little bit more about some of these reptoids, if we can. Might they be involved in any genetic crossbreeding or hybrids?
I would have to assume yes. It seems to me that we have considered the biotechnology industry to be one of the biggest industries yet ahead of us that's going to control much of the world's economies when it starts running at full pace. So if they're an advanced civilization, I would only imagine that if their technology is 50 years and upon its even 50 years or more ahead of us, that means based on the rates of progression doubling on itself every, I think it's 2 years, then their chances are that they were into genetic alterations and hybridizations and chimeras and stuff like that long before we ever were. That's what brings up the whole thing in regards to, like, Dulce base that was reported to exist in the Jicarilla Indian Apache territories in New Mexico outside a place called Dulce. That information first was released, and it brought to the public's attention this whole thing about what if we're creating super beings and such, and the reptoids were a very big part of the story of the Dulce base. And so, yeah, I would have to say that they are. I think that what we're dealing with now are information being put into genes that are being passed down or triggering something inside certain individuals to where certain parts of their own genetic coding is being unraveled, and they're dealing or they're absorbing it through their subconscious mind. And it's awakening a lot of people up to a lot of things, including their power. You know, genetic alterations, I think it can be just taken so far for physical means. Beyond that, it's a matter of genetics and their interactions with consciousness. I think that's really where, you know, everything is. We're coming down to talking about chemical messages encoded in biological tissues and stuff that have a memory to them. and experience attached to them as well. Because how can you develop webbed feet if you if your ancestors were living in a marshy environment? Eventually, you're going to get webbed feet. So the brain is passing information about the environment back to your genes, and your genes are adapting to it. This brings in this whole thing about the mutilations again. How do we know they're not telling us to keep an eye on our environment?
True.
Because they're taking the soft cheeks from the animals. This is where food first enters the mouth, and it's absorbed into soft tissues. They're taking the anus, this is, and the vaginal areas. This is where urine and fecal matter comes out, so they can see how it goes in, see how it comes out. By comparing the two, they're going to see what's missing in between, what's been absorbed in the system. And, of course, then they take the udder. So we might be looking at things where they're saying, look at your environment. It's not so much looking at the tools where you don't try and figure out the tools we're using. Just look at the message we're trying to give you. And maybe if we open up ourselves to that, we'll get tapped into what's really going on. But, yeah, it comes down to a genetic thing ultimately, because even spiritual enlightenment has a genetic connection to it. If you just stand aside and allow it to happen and be vulnerable to it occurring, I think there's a lot of great things within our genes that we've inherited that really would bring us up to the full attention of being the supreme beings that I really believe we are.
Then again, why though, John, I didn't get the answer from you last hour. Why bring the animal back? Why not just keep it? What's
exactly
the message?
Exactly. It's a message. They're trying to tell us something. And maybe, see, in a case like this, well, we know that there's a psychological operations of sorts going on. Would you not agree, George?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, absolutely.
They're either other beings or they are other people or scientists and such, and they're doing it to elicit a reaction from us. So when there is a mutilation, they are probably observing the rancher and his first contact with the scene. They are probably observing from a distance any other individuals who come up to that animal and start studying it because they want to see what the reaction is. In addition to that, once mutilation takes place, like Tom and I were discussing earlier, there's the whole thing with psychological profiling of criminals is that's been noticed, and they do it in movies all the time. They like to return to the scene of the crime. And so to observe people and see people's reactions as to what they've done. So, you know, even like myself out there having to take samples and severing the cow's head to preserve it for analysis and stuff, I'm sure that if they're out there, they're probably on some ship at some underground place. You've got beings right now listening to this radio show that are trying to analyze our reactions to what they're doing because they want to know how we're reacting. They're trying to solicit a reaction. So to those beings out there right now, I'm telling you that the entire audience listening to this show is sick and tired of your kind of behavior. We've enjoyed the game, but right now we're going to start backing our authorities like it's never happened before, and we're really going to try and get to the root of this because eventually somebody's going to have to pay. That's $1,300 per cow or per animal that's been slaughtered. That's a lot of money that those ranchers have lost.
Especially small-time ranchers.
Absolutely. So we're going to squeeze that dime out of them. I don't care what kind of currency they're carrying, but we're going to make sure that those people who have suffered through all of this and had economic loss are reimbursed. That gets back to this whole thing of why I'm trying to drum up donations, anything that anybody could send out there and want the sheriff's department to have to help them solve the bottom of this and feel like they're part of it, just send something to the address is on my website at reptoids.com. Send that in with a note saying give to the Ponderay Sheriff's Department. We'll make sure that money goes towards them. It would really be nice to deliver the news to you guys somewhere down the line is exactly what you, listeners, have actually been able to do. Rather than sit back and wait for the authorities to do it, I say take it into our own hands and let's move on.
I think it's absolutely incredible the fact that Sheriff Tom Kuka comes on the program, talks about how unusual the case is. There aren't a lot of gutsy people like that.
No, and he's a sheriff. I mean, this guy has a whole bunch of deputies over a huge county. It's not very often you get somebody of that kind of official standing actually dropping forward, and especially to get on a radio show. He asked me, he said, John, you know, am I going to get on a radio show where it's going to be a couple of guy disc jockeys who are going to have fun with this? He says, because I kind of got lured into that, and that's what happened when this story first hit. And I said, you know, Tom, if there's one man that I could absolutely trust everything too when it came to credibility and knowing that they're going to treat you right and respectfully. It's George Norrie on, and everybody on the staff and the other hosts at Coast to Coast, because it's nice to be able to have him come out and have that as a greeting and see that kind of support, rather than to feel that here we are on our own again. Why don't we just hang up our gloves?
Absolutely. John, before we take calls next hour, National Geographic just did a special on the chupacabra. And in it, they also talked about cattle mutilations, where they hypothesize that insects are doing these precision surgical removals of these organs. I can't believe it.
Well, you know, that's a little far-reaching as far as I'm concerned. That's trying to blame a microbial life form for excising precision cuts in areas. And oh yeah, by the way, they dropped it from great heights. I would like to see what kind of little bugs are going to lift a 1,300-pound cow up, throw it way up in the air to have it bounce down. Or are we dealing with microorganisms flying little flying saucers? You know? And we can't put it past that, you know, because, hey, how do we know that there are little flying saucers and these little people are out there? We just discovered the people in the Flores Islands out there in Indonesia. Anything's possible.
I agree. Back to the chupacabra. What do you think that creature is? I do believe there's something going on here.
It could be a reptoid pet. It could be just something similar to a dog. Maybe groups of them that live closer to the surface. They may have escaped into tunnel systems. A lot of these chupacabra sightings have happened around areas where there are caves and caverns and a history of different types of underworld mythologies and such. So it's entirely possible that just like some of these insects will sleep for 17 years and suddenly come up to the surface, that other beings might as well, might also come up to the surface based on cycles of time or even weather or climate or what the temperatures are or what the environment's like underground compared to what it is above. It seems to me to be more of a, I've heard the reports, and it does have a reptilian signature to its physical descriptions at times. It appears to be something more wild than it is advanced and sentient, just like we have mammals, but not all mammals are sentient like humans are. So we might be dealing with reptilian hybrid animal life forms that have been living underground coming up. We just don't exactly know, but what we do know is on some scale that they're doing exactly the same things as these mutilators by taking the blood. So it comes down to blood with these animals, a lot of it. And we've got to remember, bovine blood is interchangeable with human blood for a fast transfusion and such like that. Whatever's happening with the blood in those animals, and they're not completely drained, because when I cut through that 1,200-pound Peterson cow, the blood pooled towards the bottom, which naturally happens when things die. There was a lot of blood missing, but it's not entirely bone dry. So what is it with the blood that they're doing? What is it that maybe the chupacabras with these incisions they found with animals not having any blood, is it really happening of aliens, or is it somebody trying to do it so, you know, there was a mutilation a number of years ago in which Keith Wolverton in his book Mystery Stalks the Prairie in 1975 wrote the Columbia Press said that they found a mutilation in which there were surgical gloves and an army bag with a scalpel in it and a bovine penis left there. So I think that sometimes some of these things are happening to where there are real cases, then there are cases where evidence is left behind, so we think that the rest of the cases are all accredited to the same guys that left the army bag, for example, and we write them all off. So the chupacabras, one of these days, one of them is going to be hit by a car.
Like
it's
going Bigfoot.
To be roadkill.
Like Bigfoot.
Yeah. Well, I prefer to hit a chupa than a Bigfoot. You know, we people up in Montana hear deer a lot, especially in the city of Helena, because they just walk from one yard to another down here in this big sky country, also Bigfoot country. But I don't know if I'd want to hit a something the size of a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot, looking at just what a deer can do.
There are so many creatures on this planet that haven't been discovered yet. Why are, like the chupacabras, so elusive?
Because they're living in areas which our eyes are not usually glancing towards. Most of it's underground. We have to remember that we've only discovered about 2.5% to maybe 4% of all life on Earth. That means that there's millions and millions and millions of other animals, including large mammals, I might add, that are in the dense forests and in the remote countryside and such, or in remote mountain areas and underground, that the forms of which we could only imagine. It's like, you know, they find the jellyfish at the bottom of the ocean that can replicate the body forms of like 17 other different predator fishes in order to survive. So you've got this inherent intelligence that's expressing itself throughout nature, and it's only now even our scientists, when they're building products for defense industries and such, they're looking towards the animal life world in order to learn how their eyes see in the dark, so we can build instrumentation based on it. So the nature kingdom is teaching us a lot, and I think that we have one of the greatest surprises ahead of us in mankind, which is finally coming into contact with something else that's non-human and is sentient and intelligent and probably very advanced. And because of this, it's going to elicit a lot of fear, a lot of different reactions, and there's going to be a lot at stake. And one of the things is our soul and the determination of where we go from this life forward. And those times might be coming fast in advance of us. And it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yeah, it sure is, John. There's no doubt about that. Do you think there's any danger in any of this? You know, David Jacobs, who's going to be a guest on one of the programs soon, believes that there's something nefarious going on. Do you?
There's always something nefarious going on. There's always groups that are going to try and get one over on the other group. So, yes. It's like there's always a conspiracy because there's just always conspiracies, whether you've got your wife a present and you're not going to tell her what it is, or whether, you know, it's a company not sharing the secret Coca-Cola ingredient with all their competitors. There's all these different conspiracies going on, and everybody wants a cut of the pie. What's really interesting is that even behind the UFO scenes, the people that inherited that information from the onset of discovering UFOs and following into it, the people that really know more than we do, and we can only surmise what they might know, these guys in themselves have split and divided into different various groups and compete with each other to control what's going on. So it's not a matter of just the government against the people. It's actually all this chess playing even between intelligence groups. And the whole Bush administration, everything, is trying to drive that all into one big super house of information. And it's interesting how these other groups are going to be playing against each other and what kind of events are going to be taking place and which ones are going to be allowed to be known versus which aren't.
Well, this is going to be pretty interesting over the next several years because, as you talked about earlier, 2012 is only 6 years away, actually five now when you think that we're ready to flip into 2007. And you really believe something strange and mysterious is going to occur, John?
I would like to think so. In my heart, I believe that I feel that way only because of what's going on down in Mexico City with all the UFOs that have been seen down there and have allowed themselves to be seen. The beings themselves are very much into symbolism. That can't be denied, even all the crop circles. It's just a symbolic thing that they're doing. So if you're talking about date symbolism and what we put forth as far as consciousness, if humans are expecting something to happen, does it always do us good for it not to come true? Sometimes, even under purposeful design, when our expectations are met because they want us to keep the belief. Remember what happened at Fatima. These people, 77,000 plus, gathered together and saw the spinning disc come out of the clouds, a metallic object splitting off light and everything. But the children were having visions of the Mother Mary. Now, that's connecting UFOs and religious experiences for very well-meaning people. And so it shows, it demonstrates, as far as I'm concerned, that they want us to have faith. They want us to think that there's something more out there. And in today's world, where all you're being is spoon-fed stuff on television, and from one moment to another, your attention is being split away, really, I think that we need to back up out of that and start looking around us and experiencing life rather than just absorbing what is being given to us and provided to us, because it's really an illusion. And the only way really to be free is to get your ego out of the way and say, you know what, maybe we're just not alone, and maybe we need to learn from somebody else once and for all.
Well, maybe we have to do that. I just think that's going to be a great time. It's going to be a great time to be on the air broadcasting.
Hey, listen, December 22nd, 2012, that's when I would like to be sitting there on a rock and being in the perfect place at the perfect time and with my heart completely at peace, knowing that just as you cross that transition point, you might be guiding or directing your soul into an irreversible journey for the rest of many, many, many lifetimes to come. And as long as we think that way, we're always going to be trying on a personal level to improve ourselves, to acknowledge nature, and to be good to each other, because really that's all we got.
Well, that's true, too. Well, it's going to be soon enough. John, how do people get information on the DVD?
Go to the website, www.reptoids.com. There is a link up there talking about the Montana mutilation. That's where we're going to have upcoming information. By the way, there are developments that I'm very excited about that I will be sharing with you down the line, George, and your listeners will get it too in time. But if you go to that website at the on the page, you'll see it talking about the DVD. 20% of the proceeds are being provided to the Ponderay Sheriff's Department for their animal mutilation forensic and evidence analysis. And so please support these guys in the field. Any donations you might have, send those in. They really need your help. And keep up the good work, everybody, because keep the faith. That's all I got to say.
All right. Stay with us, John, because next hour we're going to take phone calls from you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Some great stories on the coasttocoastam.com hot stories list. Scientists, for example, levitating small animals with sound. That's an incredible story. And how about the story about Bob Lazar? His company, United Nuclear Company, is selling trace amounts of polonium-210 for $69. I assume he's licensed from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which allows vendors to sell small amounts. The buyers have to receive special permission from the United States government. And Bob Lazar's company is selling it. Bob, of course, attracted national attention when he claimed to have worked on crashed alien spaceships at Area 51. We're going to try to get a hold of Bob and talk about this. You know, it is polonium-210 that apparently killed that former Russian spy and might even have knocked into unconsciousness the former prime minister of Russia. We'll be back in a moment with John Rhodes. Your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, John, we're working on some shows for the Sci-Fi Network in terms of news content shows. You and this subject matter would be fantastic. And if things go as planned, we'll get a hold of you on this, okay?
Okay, very good. I'd love that.
Let's move on to some callers now because it's filling up fast. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George, this is Gary in San Antonio.
Hi, Gary.
Speak with you.
Thank you.
I'd like to share a couple of thoughts with you and your listening audience I believe you'll find interesting.
Okay.
The first is about cattle mutilation. Several years ago, I came across a map of the United States showing the locations of mutilated cattle. All, underline all of them, are clustered in groups, either downwind or downstream of nuclear missile silos, nuclear bases, nuclear power plants, storage and waste disposal sites.
Interesting.
Well, you know, unlike you, George, I don't believe in coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
Cattle and humans are very similar in their blood and their organs, so I don't think it's much of a stretch of the imagination to consider that the Department of Energy may be harvesting cattle to examine them for the residual effects of radiation and using planted alien stories as cover for their black ops.
What do you think of that, John?
Well, that's entirely possible. That might even just be one of many reasons it might be going on. You know, sometimes certain things that take place suit several purposes and several reasons. And I think that he very well might be right on track. It gets back to this thing about the environment. This particular mutilation happened actually upwind from the nearby nuclear missile silo, which is still manned, but they believe that the missiles have been removed. Maybe it's a switching station or something. But we have to remember also that nuclear missile silos are perfectly suited for opening up hatches and having circular things go in and out of them, including craft. So we can't discount the possibility that some of these activities are taking place from those locations or those points of origin. The upwind, downwind thing, I know that there is organic farming going on upwind of where this most recent cattle mutilation was. I do believe it has to do, obviously, from my perspective and obviously yours, that there's some sort of a connection there with food chain, environment, maybe even different things to do with genetics, but there's definitely something going on. And there's, it gets back to that underlying message. What do you think the message might be?
Personally, I think the message is the Department of Energy is looking for the residual effects of radiation on cattle since they are so close to humans in their blood and organs.
Well,
possible.
When we were out there, Sheriff Kuka took Geiger counter readings and didn't notice anything out of normal specs. So it's probably whatever's happening is probably long term. It gets back to that thing about there's so many areas to speculate on. I do agree though that samplings have to be taken from the natural environment in regards to where farming is occurring and also different types of disposal areas that there are. So yes, there is a very good valid point that the caller's making.
George, may I share one other thought?
Sure, Gary.
I've been trying to get a hold of you since your JFK assassination broadcast. Here's something most people don't know. If you look on an aerial map of the exact location of JFK's assassination, he was shot at the apex, at the top of four intersecting streets that form an unfinished pyramid.
That's bizarre.
In the back of your dollar bill.
Yeah.
Out of order chaos, out of chaos order. Novus Ordo.
Well, yeah, that's exactly, you know, that fits even in with what we're talking about with mutilations and even the reptoid activity. There's always these nods and these winks going on. I mean, haven't you noticed that that's quite apparent in most of this activity, that it's almost like a tauntingness, like we're not supposed to see this, but, you know, it's like, why shoot him where all the apexes come together? Go ahead.
Would you go on an expedition, John, for the reptoids?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've spent untold, endless amount of days climbing mountains and looking for locations of where these things have been reported. And if I saw one, and I've even told news crews this before, if I knew where they existed, could be found, I'm not sure that I would be so quick to suddenly blurt it out because, you know, when that Bishopville, South Carolina case took place back in 1988, that town down there was flooded with people from all over the place, many of which were packing shotguns and wanting to take hounds into the swamps and shoot this thing because, you know, there's no good beast better than a dead beast, and that's the way some people think. So, you know, that gets back to that whole thing about the responsibility of informing people as to this current status and the truth of it. My good friend John Lear says the same thing. You know, can we handle it? I mean, we might say we can, but we represent a very small fraction of people that are in this nation that believe in what we believe in, but they don't want to spend the time thinking about it more than just beyond science fiction in the movie theater.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hey, George, this is Tom from Pueblo, Colorado.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
You know, I was just curious. I live in southern Colorado here, and I was listening to your stories about the mutilations or so-called mutilations up there in Montana. What other sort of mutilations have you studied from, you know, around the U.S., and how do they differ from the ones in Montana?
A lot of the mutilations are very similar to each other. There's obviously a certain set of organs that are always taken. You know, there seems to always be tissue from the eye or liquid fluids from the eye. There's cheekbone taken. There's sometimes nostril incisions. There's the udder that's gone, the anus that's cored out. Different things like this, including different types of slashings. It really does run the gamut. And southern Colorado out there, especially towards the Four Corners area, which gets into the direction of a lot of anomalous activity, a very high concentration of UFO and anomalous phenomenon happening in the Four Corners area here in the United States. It's just unimaginable to think of all of this going on, and after almost 60 years of it, we haven't been able to quite wrap our heads around it and find out what's going on.
Do you think, John, that you brought it up, Mothman might have been a reptoid?
Possibility. We're talking about when people looked up and saw what they saw a figure flying in the air that seemed to have its eyes, glowing red eyes, lower than its shoulders. And I believe that this could very well have been a levitating humanoid or somebody that had some sort of levitation device or something like a Draco that could have been suspended in the air and hooked its head down low as if to observe something on the ground, but from a viewpoint from the ground upwards, the lowered head would appear with the reflecting eyes, like cat's eyes sometimes reflect, that the eyes are actually in the chest. Now, that doesn't even fit the parameter of most animals that we know of. But when you think of how something could be flying and it could be looking down with its outstretched neck like that, how it might be seen as being something like that. It definitely was around during a period of where there was going to be a lot of psychic trauma going on just later with the accident on the bridge. So there's some sort of maybe, how do we know that being in the Mothman prophecies wasn't actually trying to warn us of an event that was about to take place, like trying to scare us away or get our attention to it? You know, we can't always
that's always possible.
Yeah, we can't always think that these things are the orchestrators of this. Maybe sometimes they show themselves or do things in order to help us, but we're just always looking the other way.
Next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm big driving a truck right now in Warsaw, Indiana. I had a quick question for John. Do you feel that dogs, like domestic pets, do you think that they are a result of genetic engineering, or do you think that it's breeding that's created all these different kinds of dogs that we have, breeds of dogs? It's kind of hard to believe that, you know, that they crossbred all these dogs to create all these different kinds of dogs that we have. What do you think?
We know that we even in modern history have crossbred dogs for new breeds and such like that. But I think just recently they found out that the eve of all dogs, or I guess you could say the root of a lot of dogs, end up going back to China. Isn't that George a number of years ago they made that report talking about that? Do you remember that?
Yes.
And I do know that the only dog I've seen that are so unusual that would make me question as to whether some sort of manipulation is going on, even with dogs, the canines, is that there was a dog associated with the Aztecs down in Mexico. And to this very day, I can't even figure out how to wrap my tongue around its name. It's one of those really difficult names to say in the Mexican language.
It's not the Sharpei, right?
No, it's not. It's called the Cutsacuplitle or something like that. This dog is so unusual. It has no fur. Okay, it sweats. And it actually cries.
When it cries?
Upset, yes, when it gets upset, tears, it will have tears. Now, that is a very unusual animal, especially to have come from an area so rich in history, like with Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent being, man or whatever, that showed up down in Mexico to give all this knowledge of all these different things to the ancient Aztecs and actually lift them out of the bloodshed that they were in into a religion of more of one of peace and love. But I don't know. I'm sometimes at a loss with all that stuff.
And you say this dog was from the Aztecs in those days?
Yeah, it was attributed to the Aztecs, but see, the Aztecs, we still have to remember what's going on in Mexico City.
These all right, how about this? Is this it? XOLOITCUINTLI.
Go ahead, give it a shot, George.
Man, I'm not even going to guess. I'm going to see
yes,
if this is it.
Yes, that's the dog.
That is.
Now that you've had it spelled out there, everybody can hit the internet and go look at the dog. They'll say, that's an unusual dog.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, so just to close that off, remember the Mayans, we don't know their origins, the original Mayans. They had high degrees of technology. They may have been Atlantean descendants who arrived in Central America, and they could be looking for something to return home to pull them off this planet before things get out of hand. So when you attribute a dog like that to that region of the world where even aliens to this day show themselves en masse, you have to wonder, I wonder what was going on in those caverns underground.
Good point. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you doing? And John,
good.
How are you?
Thank you.
Hi, fine, thanks.
Great. I've actually got some information about the mutilations and then a couple of or comments or questions.
Sure, go ahead.
First off, I think when I was about 18 or so, I'm thinking that's around 1973 or so, I don't remember exactly, but it was about the first time I heard of these mutilations and stuff, okay? And I remember watching a show on TV where they had found some of these cows that were dead and mutilated, and what they did is they couldn't figure it out, and they were wondering whether it was natural causes or not. So what they did was they actually killed a cow, laid it out on the side, and actually put a camera up, and they video camered the thing. They were taking photographs. They took a video of the thing, and like the camera was hidden, and they were away. So like they weren't there, so any predators could come around if they wanted to. But
right.
What it is I saw the actual video, and you can see where the animal starts to bloat up. And
yeah,
it
excessive
very quickly.
Yes, excessive bloating immediately.
Well, just a moment. They said the bloating starts up, and
right.
Then the through the anus comes most of the organs and stuff. They actually extend way out, and they go, and then they start to shrink back in, but they're being eaten away. Okay, and then they actually later on when they did is actually they cut it open, and they said, yeah, this thing it was just this, but it looks like it was surgically removed because it's right back to the, you know, like the beginning of the anus, like looks like it's right from there on up. They've taken it all out. Okay, and same thing with some of the some cuts and stuff, and on the side of the face where they had on the lower side where it was touching the ground, you had a similar action happening. Now, I'm not sure if that sort of solves all of them or not. There's probably some that aren't. But I'm just wondering, like when I actually saw this video, I saw it on twice. Now, since then, I've never, ever seen it on TV again. We've heard about mutilations, you know, a zillion times since then. But my sort of questions on the same side were, when you were saying the face was removed, like, was that the downside?
No, it's actually the upper part and the lower part, all the way back to the termination point where the ear is almost.
Okay. Well, see,
it was about 4 inches up from the bottom part of the molar to the top area incised line, and then from the bottom jaw, from the top of the molar down, it was about 3 inches, and it actually curled over and took out one of the nostrils.
Oh, okay. Well, you see, the thing is, these bacteria and stuff basically go in the mucous membranes and from all ends, like the, you know, at the front and the
right,
you know, from the scrotum and stuff, they go in there because of that reason and into the nose because of that reason and maybe in through the mouth because of the reason. I don't know about that end. But they showed this whole work, and then they were also talking about gashes and stuff that were on the top. They said those didn't have the same action because they weren't subject to be sitting on the ground where they're moist, and also the insects and flies came and actually sort of ate and cleaned that area sort of thing. Okay, so they didn't have the same problems with the stuff on the top. So that may explain why that cow that you're saying was cut open on top wasn't taken, okay? And I had a
right.
Quick comment on the depressions. I'm just wondering, I don't know the details, you know, but could the sick animal, whatever, have fallen, made a depression, and then staggered a little farther and fallen for good then?
No, actually, because what would happen is when it pulled itself upright, you would see a staggering motion where feet would be dragging along the ground, or at least a hoof dragging along the ground, at least for a certain period before it collapsed again. And that's not what it looked like. There wasn't a whole bunch of dirt that had been piled up underneath a foot, like a foot had moved forward and then collapsed down on top of it. It does look very deliberately like its head was pointed towards, I remember, the south-southeast, and or the north-northeast. And the animal, when it was laid out, there was stubble around it that was still standing upright. Now, you got to remember, I got there about 5 weeks afterwards, but because of the cow actions around the Valier cow number 62, because of the cows coming around there, and then the one of the some students from Bozeman came out with Montana State University, filmed some of this stuff, and the sheriff had been already out there. So some the crime scene had started to already deteriorate, but it certainly did look like they had placed it right next to that fence. It always gets back to that thing, is it's right next to the fence. You know, and why? You've got almost 600 acres out there into which to deposit something, but it's not. It's right next to the fence.
We'll be back with final questions with our guest, the crypto hunter, John Rhodes, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. This is our final segment with our special guest, John Rhodes, also known as the crypto hunter. How did you get that title, John?
Well, I just kind of kept thinking about all the things that I had been researching, and the only thing that I could ever think of was that I just hunt down hidden mysteries, is because when you start to look into one area of the phenomena that we're engaged in today's culture, then it draws you into other areas. So the blanket thing was looking for anything hidden, and of course this gets into the aspect of looking for other beings that are extensions of Earth life forms, and gets into cryptozoology. And so, therefore, I'm a hunter of mysteries and a hunter of different kinds of wild animals, as well as the ones that are sentient and that might take you for a ride on their flying saucer if given a chance.
Back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, it's Barbie from the Fantastic Forum. I'm in Los Angeles.
Hey, Barbie, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Nice to hear you and John tonight.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you very much.
Listen, last summer, and I don't recall the date, but I can tell you it was the last Wednesday in August 2005, I think I grabbed a reptilian in my bedroom.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well, tell us what happened.
All right. I'm very light sensitive, and I had just shut off the TV. My kitten, Calvin, who is all white, was lying at the foot of the bed. I had just turned over and shut my eyes. And you know how it is if your computer comes on in the middle of the night and it automatically wakes you up?
Right.
Have you ever had that happen? Well,
yes.
Only I wasn't asleep yet. I had just closed my eyes. And I thought the computer, somebody had hit the computer mouse and turned it on. And the whole room was filled with this strange green light that was coming in through the Venetian blinds that were about two-thirds shut. And I thought, now, well, this is really strange, because I'm looking at my cat, and his ears are glowing red. And he's looking at something that's behind my head. Well, I tried to turn my head, and I suddenly realized I couldn't move. And Howard was laying 6 inches from me, and I was going to reach over and nudge him and say, wake up, there's something in the room. You're a non-believer, now you're going to believe this. And I couldn't reach him because it was like there's a force field between his arm and my arm. And I turned my eyes as far up towards the head of the bed as I could, and I could see in color some appendage. Now, I don't know if it was an arm or a leg, but there was a being standing behind my pillow next to the wall, and I could see through him. And it was like he was in camouflage colors. But it was not a uniform. It was like the whole appendage was in camouflage colors, but I could see through it. And I thought, all right, if I can't reach to Howard, maybe I can reach to you. And as my mind thought that, I grabbed forward, and I could move my arm forward, but just not side to side. And I got a hold of whatever it was, and it slithered out of my hand very quickly and leaped way back out of my reach. And it felt like one of those blue ice packs that you buy at the store and you put in your ice chest, but it felt like how that feels when it's thawed out. It's not wet on the outside, but it's squishy kind of. Anyway, I'm thinking to myself, don't go anywhere. I have questions for you. I want to ask you something. And all of a sudden, I could feel like a vibration. Now, it was not painful or anything like that, but it started at my crown chakra, and it went all the way down through my body. And I thought, well, if he thinks he's punishing me, he's out of luck because this feels good. And then it stopped, you know. He stopped, and I said, come on now, don't go, don't go. And if you're going to go, take me with you for a little while because I've got questions I want to ask you. And all of a sudden, he was just nowhere to be found, and the light in the room changed back to the normal light of the street lamp coming through the blinds, and it wasn't green anymore. And I'm laying there, and I'm thinking, well, bull crap, you know. He got away. But my cat, my poor cat, went into a frenzy, and he bounced off every piece of furniture and all the walls in the house for the next half hour.
Typical guy, Barb. He got you got serious. He ran away.
I guess. You know, that was it was just such a strange experience. I had a similar experience, but I didn't see anything when I was in Laughlin 2 years ago at the IUFOC, the UFO Congress.
Right.
I had the same kind of vibration come into my perfectly dark room one night, and it was the same kind of vibration that went all down through my body, and I had the same thought. Oh, this feels good. Now, if you want to sit and talk, I'm ready. Just let me sit up, and I'll talk to you person to whatever you are. And all of a sudden, it stopped, and the thought that was left in my head was, sorry, wrong room.
Wow.
Sort of sounds like Pamela Stonebrook, John. Have you heard of her?
Yes, I have. You know, there seems to be just, I guess, what we're looking at here is a situation in which there have been certain beings, reptilian humanoids, that have appeared to people that have an emotional attachment to that particular individual. And sometimes it's perceived as sexual, but it's not, because it's, like I said, it has something to do with energies more than just a physical act, because I think we're talking about the beings that are sometimes physical and sometimes non-physical. So there's a matter of vibration happening. But the thing was, as you were saying, that you could, like, see through him. Now, there's another case that we've heard, and it's on the Internet, actually. The individual has shared it, in which there was a reptoid at the end of his bed, and he tried to think of what to do, or even if it were real, and he picked up an object that was next to the bed and threw it, and it went through the reptoid.
Hmm.
So that reptoid was half physical, partly not.
Dimensional.
But, yeah, he was phasing in and out and in and out. And he looked somewhat kind of almost bored but slightly amused, touched something on his belt, and completely disappeared. But there does seem to be some sort of, like, relationship thing going on, where just as if maybe you had think of yourself like a person out in the wilds of Africa, and you're a warden over a certain area, and you have certain animals that you've interacted with before. You tag them, they go down, they're kind of phased out. You do things to them and such like that. Now, you disappear. That animal's going to be in shock, but it doesn't mean that you didn't like it. I mean, it didn't like you. There could be something going on that's really kind of cool, but everybody's in a state of shock. You're lucky enough to have been lucid enough to actually engage. And I've seen this over time and time again. When you're dealing with these guys, they respect willpower, and they respect. And as long as you're respectful towards them and don't give them an inch, in other words, don't let them see you're afraid or anything like that, because sometimes they'll react to fear thinking that they're about to be attacked, because, you know, it's the same organ in the brain that perceives this flight or fight, and you could be sending out signals of your brain that he's sensitive to, where he's not sure which one it is, and he might just, you know, attack you back because out of a sense of self-preservation. So you just have to, you know, be cool with them, and they will be cool with you, and just try and hold the demons inside your own dreams away at that point.
Hey, John, what if we had a nuclear war a long time ago, and the reptoids were merely humans that have mutated?
Oh, wow. Well, that would make an interesting movie, see?
It sure would.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's evidence all over the world that there has been some sort of high heat that could only be generated by some sort of thermonuclear blast on the surface. I know that in New Mexico, there's an area so much like that, which glass is actually fused together. So, yeah, who knows how far this goes back. It might be going back to those wars in the Mahabharata, where they saw these guys flying around in the clouds and having big battles and stuff.
Yeah, something happened. Let's go to our wild card line. Thanks for holding. You're on the air with us.
Yeah, hi, John. Hi, George.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. Hey, yeah, some interesting theories coming from some of your callers, but the one that I was thinking of was your interview with Linda Moulton Howe the other night. Yeah, I don't think you discussed it with John in reference to the water tank and the mutilated cows that they found inside the water tank.
We didn't bring up that portion of it, but we did talk about the case in Montana.
Right, and I am aware that animals have been left at a height before, and so we know that they're being dropped from heights. It's just a matter of, you know, God, in a water tank, you'd think, are they contaminating the water? Aren't they even concerned about that?
Yeah, how do they get in? And then the plasma beams, that people won't come forward and actually openly say that they saw, other than the Linda Moulton Howe, the plasma beam theory.
There are a lot of ranchers, and these are just down-to-earth, ordinary people that are just good American, hardworking American men and women. And they that have had these things occur on their ranches, many of them say they have given in to the fact that they know that this is being done by something that may be extraterrestrial or even interterrestrial. So, you know, you've got a degree of people that are always going to be in denial, but the battle, if you wanted to go to a place to see a UFO in the United States, mm-hmm. I'm telling you right now, that Golden Triangle area in there where those mutilations are happening right now, we've had these occur. It happens in clusters between 3 or 4 years, sometimes as many as 67 of them. If anybody wanted to spend a vacation, come to that beautiful, beautiful area up there of like Valier or DePoyer or anything like that, and stay at one of those inns, enjoy the scenery around there, and you're going to engage in talking to people. You know, many people that actually feel the same way and have been on the front lines. They're not people that are going to turn around and say, I think you're wacko. You've got a large group of people down there that are really supportive of it. So why not go to an area like that? If enough cameras hung out, maybe we will actually start getting videotape footage. I don't think those guys from the missile silo down the road from where this animal was deposited are going to share their surveillance camera footage from that evening with Sheriff or myself or anybody else. I would be very surprised if they did, because, you know, those are sensitive facilities. There's got to be surveillance cameras around there pointed outwards, and I know, as close as that is, there's got to be something on video, but we will never see it.
I agree. All right. Well, fascinating show, guys. I'll be listening later. I got to go. I got a delivery to make out here in Fresno.
Well, thanks
right,
for calling. Fresno is a great place up near there with Mariposa. There's been reptoid sightings up there as well.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on with John Rhodes on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, sir.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, gentlemen. I had a call pertaining to a gentleman that had called in earlier about the Mexican hairless dogs.
Right.
Yes.
And the pronunciation of that is called Esquinkly.
Esquinkly.
Esquinkly. And,
Esquinkly.
Yes. They are. I love animals, but these are ugly dogs.
They basically look like hairless bull terriers.
Chupacabras. They look like chupacabras.
Well, basically, yes. But they are known, and from what I've learned for probably since back in the time of the Aztecs, I don't know if it's because they have no hair, but they are known for having medicinal abilities, and they still exist in certain towns in Mexico, and I have seen them myself, and they exist because, that's not why they exist, but they people use them for arthritis remedies. They put them on their legs.
They eat them or what?
No. They
sweat?
I think because they have no hair, they let them rest up against their legs or whatever part of their body has wherever they're suffering from arthritis. And many people swear by the fact that I don't know if it's because they have no hair, but they take the arthritis away and they help them out. But, yeah, these dogs have been they're documented in the Mexican Museum of Anthropology and for, like I said, since the time of the Aztecs.
Yeah.
And there's...
Well, I've actually seen one of these dogs. I came across it. Oh, they're fascinating. I mean, just really, really strange to look at.
There's only 7,000 in North America, apparently.
Wow.
That's not a lot.
Wow. And, yeah, they're very strange. And if you think of the chupacabras, I wonder if you could sit down and befriend a chupacabra to the point of playing fetch with it.
I'll keep my yellow lab over this thing. This is, I mean, I looked at the picture during the break. I mean, that is one strange-looking critter. His ears are bigger than Spock's. West of the Rockies, you're on with John Rhodes. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi. Hello. Are you picking me up? This is Larry from Yakima, Washington.
Picking you up, Larry.
Oh, great. Hey, how you doing? My question is, it might be a little off left field, but I have a photograph of a woman and videotape of a woman holding a baby, and they're floating in the air with white light all around them. And it's an experience that started here in Yakima in September 2003, and I documented over 100 photographs and a ton of video for it.
Have you sent us any of this, Larry?
Well, no. Larry. I'm not supposed to talk about who I am, and I'm only supposed to introduce the website and launch it.
Well, we can't do that unless you tell us who you are. So that's not going to work. Oh, well. Someone tried to leak in a freebie on us, John.
Hey, you know what? You got to give him credit for the try.
Yep. But we caught him.
Right.
I can't tell you who I am, but I'll give you my website. No, not going to happen. Millions of people pick up on that thing. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hey, George, this is Adam from Akron. I'm the one that called a couple months back and told you I had the marbles in my head.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, I got two quick questions. I know we're short on time. First of all, I want to know what's the farthest that our guest has gone in his search for the cryptozoology. And second, I want to know what your favorite cryptozoological creature is, because I want to make you a drawing for a Christmas present.
You got to be kidding me. That's great. How far have I gone? Well... I've entered tunnel systems and caves and gone into the areas which would otherwise I would not have gone. Plenty of times have gone up into the mountains and I've heard things and that have absolutely scared the dickens out of me. Luckily, I have yet to come across one face to face. The favorite cryptozoological discovery, I guess, would have to be the Flores people of the islands off of Java, that they discovered that were human, but at the same time they were so small they resembled like the little people that were on the Egyptians' legs, remember?
Yes.
Where they have the little people. I mean, you have to wonder if they were back then. So sometimes I think it's going to be one of those little men that would probably be the most fascinating, because they were discovered to be real. There's all these arguments, but it enlarged everybody's imagination out there, and it really served its purpose.
John Rhodes, thank you so much. Your website, reptoids.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Good luck with the information and the DVD.
Thank you very much. And look
John
forward
Rhodes.
To speaking with you again.
Absolutely. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Wayne Roberts, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.